Good evening. You're listening to WNUR 89.3 FM HD1 Evanston, Chicago. I'm Gabby Schell.
And I'm Brendan Prizman. This is WNUR News at 6.
Between unending midterms, still too low temperatures, and, of course, the downright dystopic news, it can sometimes feel like we're living in the middle of a YA novel ourselves.
And the odds certainly haven't been in our favor. Whether it's midterms, a struggling basketball team, or wind gusts creeping up to 50 miles an hour earlier today, Northwestern students have been through the ringer.
So to help us cope with all of these challenges and celebrate 75 years of WNUR News, we're having a little Hunger Games of our own.
Well, we would be having a Hunger Games of our own. If it weren't for what? If it weren't for the baby. Just kidding. The only baby is this show, which we are extremely proud to bring you tonight.
From heinous torture and hot takes to an interview with campus celebrity Josh McKenzie to our very own Hunger Games, this show has it all. So without further ado,
welcome to the Quarter Quell with WNUR News.
As the tributes stand on their podiums, the horn sounds. And by tributes, I mean all of us here at WNUR. Do we go into the cornucopia? No. We all run away. The bloodbath ends. Nobody dies. Here's Basil Free and Yumi Talud with a discussion about the Hunger Games.
In the spirit of this quarter special broadcast theme, we at WNUR News of course had to put out a story about maybe the most popular young adult series of all time, The Hunger Games.
That's where Yumi and I stepped in, assembling a roundtable of diehard fans to discuss all things about the books. Though we originally set out to attempt to map where we thought all of PenM's districts were, the conversation quickly divulged into tangents on our personal connections with the series.
Even though all our experiences with the books were different, one thing stayed the same between all of us, a shared love for the story that we grew up with.
So, let's listen in, first hearing our panelists introduce themselves.
I'm Luis Castaneda, and I'm a third year in Medill.
I'm Alexia Sextu, and I'm a first year in Medill.
Before diving into district talk, we had our panelists describe their first introduction to the world of PenM. Here's Castaneda.
I remember the first experience I ever had with The Hunger Games was, I guess maybe it was 2012.
Wow.
And I was in my sister's room. I remember I must have been like 9. She had it playing on her TV, like we were watching it together. And I was like, what's going on? And I didn't really understand it at the beginning. And then I think it wasn't until Catching Fire, the second one, came out that I was like, oh, this is like, it's good. And since then, I feel like I've seen Catching Fire over 11 times.
Sextu then offered her story.
They were playing the Hunger Games, and then my grandpa told me to go to bed. And I said, no, I really want to watch this. And he's like, no, because the TV was like in his room. So I got my iPad and I Googled this like really sketchy illegal site. I was like, Hunger Games movie thing. And I watched all 4 movies same night.
Wow.
I pulled an all-nighter, probably the first all-nighter I pulled in my life.
Moving to the districts, we theorized over the location of the capital, Panem's place of glitz, glamour, and corruption.
Yeah, why is she in Salt Lake City?
That's a great question. Because I remember, I feel like they talked about the capital being somewhere in like the Rockies, like Colorado, like Utah area.
Sextu had a different theory.
I feel like it would be Manhattan.
I would agree.
Right, no, yeah, you would think.
Wouldn't you think? Like, with the champagne glasses and the crazy eyelashes? Yes,
and
that's what it is.
It's interesting too, because the East Coast is District 13. So it's like the exact opposite of what you'd expect.
That's true. Yeah. But it's giving Gatsby, but futuristic.
Right, right.
Castaneda then considered the capital's geographic surroundings.
It would make sense, like, I guess, territorially, for the capital to be like in a very like isolated like location. It kind of reminds me of Colombia.
Oh.
So Colombia, the capital is on this large plateau So in Bogota, it's surrounded by like kind of mountains.
We talked about where we're from and where in Panem that would potentially be. Basil's from Toledo, Ohio, meaning he would probably be from District 3.
Based on the map, it seems like my district would be District 3, the Power District, mm-hmm. or sorry, the Tech District, mm-hmm. which makes sense given like the history of like the Rust Belt and many of like the Great Lakes cities in like Ohio and Michigan being like hubs of infrastructure and like innovation. Uh-huh. But I laugh because I'm just like, those are all kind of dead now. So I'm like, in this universe, would these like factories be bought back? Mm-hmm. Like, is the Rust Belt no longer rusty anymore?
Right.
Yumi is from Chicago, meaning they would likely be from District 6, which focuses on transportation.
Which is funny, because Chicago right now notoriously does not have great transportation.
What, you don't like the L train? What?
I can't say I do.
What a shocker.
Sextu is from Greece, and Castaneda is from Florida, a state that doesn't exist in Panem as a result of global warming. In their cases, they discuss what districts they thought they would be from.
Okay, you know what? I want to say I would be from 4, which is Phoenix District. It's the fishing one. It's kind of like right up. Is it California?
I think
so.
Like
a little above California.
Yes, like most of the California coast.
I think that's where I would be like. I mean, water makes sense to me because I'm from a coastal country. So, yeah.
Castaneda, on the other hand, was drawn to District 10.
In like practicality sense, probably is like my calling, mm-hmm. because I literally grew up in the horse capital of the world.
Though our focus on the districts may have shifted, our conversation then moved to center on the impact of the series, both on us and the wider culture. Here's Castaneda.
This franchise has united so many people, and I don't know what it is that appeals to so many people. It has such an impact. You know, that's so different than like Harry Potter, so different than Divergent, so different than, I don't know, I feel like it's the cool, you know, young adult novel.
Here's Sextu's take.
So when you say about why it appeals so much, I think it has to do with the fact that it's taking such an extraneous concept and it's making it seem so timely and so real, to the point where even today, if you go on social media where people are talking about politics today, they'll be like, Suzanne Collins warned us about this. She said it.
Sextu also gave out particular praise to Suzanne Collins, the author of the books, and her writing.
It's really political, and it's a really strong piece of writing, very imaginative piece of writing, too. Whenever I have writer's block, I think about how, like, the way Suzanne Collins like came up with this is she was flicking through her TV one day, and she was watching, you know, news coverage on some conflict or some war, and then she pressed next, and there was, like, this reality, like, game show or whatever happening.
Collins is set to publish the 5th book of the series, a prequel called Sunrise on the Reaping, on March 18th. Castaneda shared his feelings.
So I'm excited to see what happens in this next book and what message she's trying to give us then, because considering how much political turmoil is going on right now, I wonder if she's gonna try to tell us something about ourselves in this book.
Looking toward the future, Sextu offered a final thought on the upcoming book.
I trust her completely to write another novel that is going to be relevant in one way or another, if not now, which I think it will be, but even if not now, definitely later in the next couple of years, we'll certainly see it, because that's exactly what her writing does.
Through it all, the world of Panem and the story of the Hunger Games has stuck with us, and is something that we're all excited to keep in our lives.
Thanks for listening, and as always, happy Hunger Games. For WNUR News, I'm Basil Free.
And I'm Yumi Talud.
Are you coming to the tree? They strung up a man.
I'm glad to hear the Hunger Games played such a big part in other people's lives, because it certainly defined my middle school years. And on that note, let's check in on our little Hunger Games.
The sun is still shining. The birds are chirping. Our first day isn't even over yet, but our Hunger Games has claimed its first victim. Our executive producer, Jess Watts, is dead. Stabbed to death by reporter Naya Reyes.
How will WNUR News ever recover from such a violent loss?
I mean, stabbed to death? Like, it's bad, but it's not that violent. Like, when you compare it to stuff like The Rack, The Iron Maiden, being hung, drawn and quartered, that thing where the horses tie you up and then go in four different directions. Like, that sounds bad. I'd take a stabbing over those any day of the week.
I don't know. I think maybe you paid more attention in the medieval torture unit than I did, Brendan.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
But, I mean, hey, some people really get into that stuff, and to each their own. But what causes this fascination with medieval torture? Sophia Kesa and Gabe Shumway have the story.
We would like to start out by issuing a trigger warning. This story will be gory and discusses in-depth forms of medieval torture practices. If you are listening live on the radio, this package will last for 8 minutes and 12 seconds before we move on to the rest of the show. When I learned about King Henry VIII in school, I was told to remember his wives by saying, "Divorced, beheaded, died. Divorced, beheaded, survived." When you think about the French Revolution, one of the premier images is the guillotine. And even today, true crime TV shows and podcasts are all the rage and have a cult-like following. But when did this gruesomeness become so normalized?
In honor of this quarter's special broadcast being Quarter Quell, we thought it fitting to look at quartering, a medieval torture practice. This was a method primarily in England, where treasonous were quite literally ripped apart at the seams. Our initial research on this practice left us with so many unanswered questions. Why was quartering practiced? Who came up with this idea? Why are people still fascinated by medieval torture today?
It's startling in dinner conversations when I first meet people and tell them that I do medieval crime and punishment and gruesome spectacles and those kind of things.
That's Patricia Turning, a professor of history at Albright College. She teaches courses on violence and torture in the pre-modern world, medieval prisons, and everything in between. She emphasized that treason was one of the worst crimes that someone could commit in medieval England, and that quartering was reserved for these sorts of extreme crimes.
Scott Sowerby, an associate professor of history at Northwestern, also emphasized just how extreme quartering could be.
I think people might not realize just how gruesome quartering was.
This would have been reserved for, like, the worst of the worst. And so this would have been, like, the conspirators in the Babington plot. That was the plot that was going to kill Queen Elizabeth. Or the gunpowder plot. That was a plot that was going to blow up all of Parliament.
But just how bad was the process of quartering itself? Obviously, it was a form of torture reserved for some of the worst criminals. But what exactly did it look like?
The first part, when they tie you to a hurdle and tie you to a horse, the whole intention is not to be humane or make it comfortable, but it's meant to keep the person alive so that you get to the next stage, which is the hanging. And when you hang them, that again is not meant to kill them, but it's meant to kind of maximize the pain inflicted upon them. And then right before they lost consciousness, then they would release them, then they would eviscerate them, disembowel them, castrate them.
So that's obviously symbolically taking away their manhood. This is happening to men, and then disemboweled, which comes out of the idea that treason was something that arose in the bowels. We sometimes talk about like a gut check, or, you know, we have to do a gut check. And then the quartering happens, which is the body being torn, often by being tied to horses that are pulling in different directions into four pieces, which is called quartering.
Agitate those horses and have the horses shoot off in different directions, extracting the limbs in that capacity.
This punishment was gruesome, but when it comes to medieval torture, we were left wondering how they got from A to B. When someone committed a crime like treason, why would you tie their limbs to horses? Why not throw them in prison or use a different method of execution?
It's an English phenomenon, and it's very much a sense of England's understanding of this great chain of being, that everything has an order, that there's a very specific hierarchy. God controls the universe, the king controls the country, and anything like treason is seen as upsetting God's balance. So that's why treason was viewed as really the most heinous of these crimes.
They would take the different parts of the body and display them publicly in various places. So the head, if it happened in London, the head would be mounted on a spike on the south end of London Bridge so that people approaching London would have to pass underneath the heads of traitors that were being displayed there.
Quartering would have meant that they sent all four of those limbs to different quarters of the country and then put those limbs on display so that, again, this was a deterrent to kind of warn other people not even to think about challenging the monarchy or challenging the king.
Quartering wasn't the only method of torture either. Many point to King Henry VIII beheading two of his wives as torture, and it was. But according to Turning, this was as tame as it got.
If you're lucky, they decapitate you.
Yet people are still fascinated by medieval torture and crime and punishment in general. Today, there is true crime all over the media landscape. There are TV shows and movies that talk about medieval torture, but to Sowerby, quartering was so gory that it's largely unrepresented in today's media.
It happened, and you can see why this isn't ever put into, like, Game of Thrones, you know, is famously a very grisly show, but even Game of Thrones doesn't want to show these details because they're so awful.
We kept trying to figure out why torture is so fascinating to the masses. These practices happened centuries ago, and yet people all over the world keep studying them. To try and gain a better understanding, we went to a place dedicated to this very phenomenon, Chicago's Medieval Torture Museum.
In 15 minutes, we are going to learn about the wonderful, wonderful world of medieval torture.
I am both excited and scared. This seems like a fascinating place, and I don't understand what the fascination is necessarily, but that's what we're kind of here to find out.
Yeah, like, why, out of all this time, Chicago is a big city with a lot of museums, why do people want to spend their Saturday afternoon learning about torture?
When we entered this museum, the ambiance was clear. The sound was filled by the creaking of levers that visitors could pull on the old torture devices. To find out more about the visitors who came here, here's museum manager Paula Malone.
We get a lot of variety of people. People who love the macabre, people who like haunted houses, people who like history. A lot of people just in town looking for new museums, more unique museums.
Malone also implied that while there aren't many returning visitors, those who did come back often came with a new friend. They were eager to introduce others to this unique place.
The museum primarily contained artifacts. However, in some cases, ancient practices in some countries are still used in others.
The first documented case of this torture comes from the 15th century. This torture was applied to heretics in medieval Europe and to prisoners of war during the American-Spanish War in 1898 and the American-Philippine War in 1899 and by Japanese troops during the World War II. Nowadays, this torture is still used by intelligence agencies of some countries.
Many of these exhibits were designed to be unsettling. After all, what else would you expect out of medieval torture devices? It was still unique to see just how unfazed some were when looking back through history.
Sowerby believes that this normalization has simply come with time.
I think that as modern people, we've somehow transcended the barbarity of the past. Of course, we have our own barbarous side that comes out, and, you know, in wartime, but it's a sort of self-flattering, I think, ideology we have that says we've moved beyond this medieval torture.
Quartering as a practice was banned in England in 1870. It's been replaced by prisons, and the UK currently has a full ban on the death penalty. But what ushered in this new era of punishment?
Quartering was used because the state couldn't actually track down all potential traitors. It was difficult to imprison everyone who might commit treason. So the prison filled the need.
Despite quartering being an element of the past, Turning points to the cycle of history. Many say that history repeats itself, and for Turning, much of her research area can still have an impact today.
What's striking to me recently is a lot of things that I cover from the 12th century, the 13th century, the 14th century. A lot of those topics are frightfully relevant today, which is always, you know, I wish sometimes that things could stay in the medieval past. I think it speaks to the importance of knowing history and the importance of doing history and making sure that you're aware of signs so they don't creep up on you and have the same result.
For WNUR News, I'm Gabe Shumway.
And I'm Sophia Kesa.
Wow. With all the blood and gore we just heard about, it's probably about time to clean off. And there's no better way to clean off than with a ton of water. Where can we find some?
Hear me out. I'm thinking a water tower, maybe even a water tower place.
That is a fantastic idea. Chicago is world-renowned for its architecture, and this year marks the 50th, or double quarter, if you will, anniversary of the opening of Water Tower Place. John Kowalski is here with the scoop on the building that is two quarter quells old.
Hi there, folks. I'm currently at Chicago's Magnificent Mile, looking up at the spectacular Water Tower Place.
On October 20th, 1975, Chicago's Water Tower Place opened its doors. Containing a vertical mall, Water Tower Place combines both retail and residential space. In this Quarter Quell-themed special broadcast, I ventured to Chicago's Magnificent Mile for a closer look at the city's famous architectural feat. Walking down the Magnificent Mile toward Lincoln Park, you'll see a variety of grand skyscrapers looming over the street. Behind the historic water tower looms a large white skyscraper, one end of it being some 8 stories tall, the other end an 859-foot-tall mass of marble and concrete. Other skyscrapers along the Magnificent Mile feel somewhat warm and welcoming. Water Tower Place, in stark contrast, feels imposing and cold. Walk inside and the feeling only slightly ebbs. Upon entrance, you'll find yourself walking up 2 grand escalators flanking a cascading series of fountains. At the top of these lies the main section of mall.
So currently I'm inside Water Tower Place, and I will tell you, it is quite spectacular. There is a gigantic atrium inside of the main mall, and it just leads, I think, what is that, 7 stories up from the ground floor? It's really quite impressive.
It is actually 8 stories tall. And that glass atrium, it houses elevators that allow a bird's eye view of the space as you travel between floors. Grand as it was, what stuck with me most about the space was how dead it felt. For a main mall of the Magnificent Mile, I expected the tower to be bustling with people. Instead, many floors were rather empty. Arthur E. Osborne, vice president and general manager of the Marshall Field stores in the Chicago area, said at the opening of the mall in 1975, "We're just as excited about this as anything we've ever done. There are wall-to-wall people." Stores have been closing in the mall, like Macy's in 2021 and Sephora in 2024, very different from 1976, when every retail space was fully leased. In fact, the mall now feels somewhat like a relic of a time long ago, of a different era. Despite modern woes, the architecture of the building maintains a distinctiveness in 2025, as it did in 1975. The white starkness of the building, while cold, is also sleek and modern, minimalist in its characteristics, yet decently aged compared to buildings of a similar variety in other U.S. cities. Water Tower Place remains a significant and recognizable part of the Chicago skyline, and will remain so for a long time. For WNUR News, I'm John Kowalski.
Thanks, John, for that refreshing break. But not enough blood and death, if you ask me. Let's see how things are going back in Panem.
Well, Naya is still on the hunt, and she just destroyed our producer Georgia Kerrigan's supplies, but Georgia's getting off lucky compared to some other people on staff. At least she's still alive. Reporters Gabe Shumway, Sophia Kesa, and, well, you, Gabby, teamed up with executive producer Cara Totley to track down and kill reporter Basil Free.
Sorry, Basil. I hope you know in real life I would never do something like that to you. I mean, losing Basil would be like losing one of Northwestern's biggest icons, and I'm only sort of saying that in apology.
And Basil isn't the only Wildcat celebrity that we're checking in on today.
Now, if you're new, you may not know the name, but Josh McKenzie spent his time at Northwestern supporting students. They, in turn, made him a campus sensation. William Kramer has the story.
It's the summer of 2022. You're taking it pretty easy because, well, you just got into Northwestern. But September is coming soon, and there's so much to do. What's a TND? When was that medical form due again? You're feeling lost. Then, like the sudden appearance of an oasis in an arid desert, your phone lights up with a welcome sight. It's an email from the Purple Prep prodigy, the Wizard of Wildcat Welcome, social media sensation and assistant dean of students, Josh McKenzie.
Josh McKenzie, feel like Josh McKenzie. Josh McKenzie, I feel like Josh McKenzie.
Josh McKenzie. Even more than 2 years after his departure on that fateful winter day, Josh McKenzie's shadow looms large on Northwestern University. What was it really like writing all those emails? How did it feel to be a campus icon? What is he up to these days? Northwestern students were long overdue for a Josh McKenzie checkup, so I hopped into a Zoom with him to get some answers. First, his origin story.
Northwestern was my first stop after I got finished with my own education. Well, formal education. Really, I was looking around for jobs that were in transition programs, so like orientation, transition experiences. I did not know anything about Northwestern before I applied, but really what sold me on that series of interviews in particular was the students. I fell in love with them from the interviews and just the way that they thought, the questions that they were asking. And then I learned everything else of what Northwestern was.
Mackenzie was promptly hired into his first role at Northwestern as Assistant Director of Orientation and Parent Programs. Back then, there was little preparation for peer advisors in advance of Wildcat Welcome. There was also a need for more family involvement.
My position was overseeing all of the student leader components of the program. And so they didn't really have any type of training or leadership program. They just kind of would arrive a day or two in advance of Wildcat Welcome and prepare at that point for what they were going to be doing over the next few days. So it was building out a development, a leadership program, training for that population. It was also building a lot of family programs, initiatives, events, because they're an important support system in a student's web of support. So those were kind of my two primary focal points in that first role, and that kind of evolved from there.
During his 13-year-long tenure at Northwestern, Mackenzie would be promoted to Associate Director of Onboarding and Communication, then finally to Associate Dean of Students, where he would become the face of a new emailing program, Purple Prep.
When I started, one of the things that I was finding was that students were receiving, when they were coming into Northwestern, emails from 50 to 60 different offices throughout the summer that all had conflicting information. They had conflicting deadlines and dates, and no one was like talking to each other. And so the ability to work with so many different people across the university, to pull all of that together to create in turn Purple Prep, that was wild, but so satisfying and cool to be able to do, especially at that time period that I was doing that.
From the start of the program until his departure, Mackenzie would personally write each email. Within, he'd provide vital information for orientation, but also discuss things like the weather and how excited he was for the incoming class to arrive on campus. Most emails contained an invitation for students to meet with him if they needed anything. Many students took him up on that offer.
Part of that was because sometimes students really just didn't know where else to ask. And so while I didn't always have answers for everything, I was able to utilize my own resources that I had, my own connections, to make sure students were being heard in that process, but also helping them navigate a place that can be really confusing, especially when you're brand new to it. If you can have someone that you have some type of trust with, that you feel like is personable and not wildly robotic in interaction or whatever else, that makes it a bit easier and removes at least a barrier at some point.
Perhaps Purple Prep was too effective, though. Mackenzie was unexpectedly thrust into campus stardom thanks to the publicity from the new initiative.
That certainly evolved in a way that I wasn't anticipating. In certainly some fun ways. It always made work really interesting.
But it soon became clear that this was no simple popularity. Mackenzie had truly cemented himself as an icon, a person who would go down in Northwestern history. People would brag about spotting him on campus. A song was written. So friendly, I feel like Josh. Someone, oh my gosh. Funk the mosh. Told him my name Tosh. He said, what's up? I had to ask, what was it about him that attracted the undivided attention of students?
I don't know. I worked at Northwestern for 13 years. I don't know. I hope it's because people found that I was helpful, that I was approachable and personable, that they felt someone genuinely cared about their progression and transition. So I hope it was that. I don't know.
Despite his initial confusion at this newfound celebrity status, Mackenzie would take advantage of his fame to continue serving the student body. He frequently attended campus events and was plastered all over Northwestern-affiliated social media accounts, always providing direct support to students adapting to life at the university.
from beginning and until I left Northwestern, I worked so closely with students and I got to learn both directly and indirectly about myself, about others, about how not only we can improve, but how me, myself as an individual can improve. And so that's still one of the memories, still one of the pieces that I hold most dear is all of the different ways that learning for me happened in my time, how I interacted with students and what I learned from them in all of these small one-on-one settings.
But after spending over a decade making life easier for Northwestern students and moonlighting as a local superstar, it was time for a change. Following his departure in January of 2023, Mackenzie moved across the country to Austin, Texas.
So I live with my partner, which has been a really wonderful, like personally fulfilling experience for me to be able to be with family in that way. And so that's been one of the most exciting pieces.
Nowadays, Mackenzie enjoys working outside of higher education, although the transition initially wasn't so easy.
I don't know what people do in September, like what people can still like travel or do other things in September. I'm used to being on Evanston campus from the end of August to the end of September and not seeing really anything else outside of that. And so my first September of away from Northwestern was a little bit of a shock.
And even though he certainly can't complain about the weather in Austin, he still finds himself missing those meaningful interactions he had with students on campus.
Really what I enjoyed were just the spectrum of experience that I had with students, both the really cheerful, happy, excited moments so happy, just want to throw up, but also moments that we were able to be really vulnerable, open, mourn with each other as well. I knew at the time that I was leaving Northwestern that would be a part that I missed, so I guess I'm just proving that part of myself right.
You can take the man out of the campus, but you can never take the campus out of the man. Even from over 1,000 miles away, Mackenzie still has that drive to help Northwestern students. Although he isn't here to welcome them himself, he had some advice for the incoming class.
Please take time to be kind to yourself in all of this. Northwestern is a really challenging piece. And so taking time to understand that it's not supposed to look overly rosy at every single step of the way. And if it doesn't, that's okay. That's a part of growth. That's a part of learning. That's a part of the whole experience. And so how are you learning about yourself as you go through that? And that is something beautiful in and of itself. Taking advantage of those missteps that you're making, taking advantage of what that then can turn into in the long run. Nothing is meant to be perfect. Nothing should be perfect. And there's no definition of what perfect is when someone thinks about a college experience.
Josh Mackenzie, alongside members of Northwestern faculty, staff, and the student body, helped thousands of incoming students find their place here. On top of that, his popularity as a campus icon is everlasting. Still, he's always been willing and eager to talk one-on-one, to show students that they aren't alone. And even now, he's just a Zoom call away. On Northwestern's Evanston campus, William Kramer, WNUR News.
Telling me that I was welcome. He my man, you know I felt him. You do not know who your man's be, ay. Feeling like I'm Josh Mackenzie, yo. Ay, Josh Mackenzie, I feel like Josh Mackenzie. Josh Mackenzie, I feel like Josh Mackenzie.
Wise words from one of the men who helped start me on my wildcat journey, but in all honesty, those kinds of fuzzy feelings are always easier said than done.
I agree. I mean, things are always more complicated in real life. Or in simulations. Speaking of, what is happening back in the arena?
Well, I think our special broadcast might have angered the powers that be because a firestorm has been raining down from the sky, claiming the lives of nearly everyone in the arena.
Now that's a quarter quell they'll be playing on repeat back in the Capitol. And what a fitting way to lead into our last story of the night.
Yeah, to mark 75 years on the air, Mengjian Marklin and Kara Totley took to campus with a simple question. What's your hottest take? 75 interviews later, the responses are in, and they are just as fiery as the arena's remains.
To celebrate WNUR's 75 years in operation, we challenged ourselves to go around Northwestern's campus to ask 75 students their hottest takes. And they did not hold back. Some you'll agree with, some you'll debate, and some will leave you wondering how anyone could possibly believe that.
What's your hot take?
Sarge is the best dining hall.
I think dorm living is infantilizing.
I don't think people should be in extracurriculars that are related to their fields.
Chemistry isn't hard.
I'm an international student, and I don't like the majority of international students at Northwestern.
Mod one topping pizza isn't as bad as everyone thinks it is. Like, if I'm going to Domino's, I'm getting one topping anyway. It's not that big of a deal.
I think bananas on pizza taste good.
Pineapple is the best pizza topping.
Deep dish pizza sucks.
What's your hot take?
My hot take is that I think if you take anything other than a night shower, you're kind of a gross person.
9:30 bedtime is awesome and amazing, and like a 5:30 wake up time is also awesome and amazing.
I think nightgowns are the best type of sleepwear.
Late at night, a glass of warm milk with a little bit of honey and cinnamon hits.
I like big glasses of milk.
So I believe in putting milk in before cereal, and I also believe in putting peas on pizza.
I put my milk before my cereal. It makes it less soggy.
Dipping Oreos in water does the same thing as dipping them in milk.
What's your hot take?
Patty May's mustache is better than the beard. Everybody knows Patty May.
I think that the feels like temperature should be the temperature that's displayed. Why the are you catfishing me with double digits when it feels like -1? All right, just say the temperature is -1.
My hot take is that I don't like fizzy drinks. I think that carbonation tastes bad and it hurts my mouth.
I really do not like ice water. I just find that it makes my mouth too cold and my stomach cold.
Water is the best liquid out there right now.
1% low-fat milk is better to drink than water.
Tea is way better than coffee.
I actually really enjoy drinking black coffee.
Matcha is just grass.
Okay, so what's your hot take?
I don't think Helen Keller is real.
Even though tote bags may look cool, it's a lot of pain, so just bring a backpack. Don't use a tote bag, it's unnecessary.
Maybe not hot take is that In-N-Out does in fact have the best fast food burger.
Popeyes is better than Chick-fil-A.
I think that KFC has the best chicken sandwich.
Doritos, Locos, Crunch Tacos from Taco Bell actually taste like dog shit.
I think that all music is amazing.
My hot take is that I do not like the Brat album.
I don't like Jordan Fisher.
I really don't like Taylor Swift.
I think Chapel Round is not that good.
Rihanna over Beyonce.
Drake is better than Kendrick Lamar.
DreamWorks is better than Disney.
My hottest take is that Beauty and the Beast is the best live action Disney princess movie, but Emma Watson is not the best live action Disney princess. It's Halle Bailey as Ariel.
I hate movies.
The second and third Matrix films are absolute fire, and I'm sick of pretending they're not. Everyone calls them trash. Everyone says that the first one is a masterpiece, and the following are seeming piles of badness. And I personally believe that they are masterful accounts of the human experience and build expertly on the action and stakes of the first movie, and it should be regarded as one of the greatest trilogies of all time.
Interstellar is a good movie, but it's not that good.
Percy Jackson is better than Harry Potter.
I don't think John Mulaney is funny.
If a performance isn't good, you do not have to clap. Stay silent.
I think the trend of having stunt casting on Broadway is really stupid.
Who's Tommy is an overrated musical, and when I went to go see it, the plot made no sense.
Call Me By Your Name is a bad movie.
I don't think Timothée Chalamet is attractive even at all.
I don't think all babies are cute babies.
So, what's your hot take?
I think yellow is the worst color, and we should ban it from use everywhere. No one should ever be allowed to use yellow ever again. It should be excised from, you know, vocabularies everywhere. Shouldn't teach our children about yellow. Let's leave yellow in the past.
Orange is a top tier color.
Okay, my hot take is that watermelon is the worst fruit and tastes like nothing.
Watermelons taste like nothing.
I think frozen yogurt is extremely overrated.
Hot pot is overrated.
Corn is not meant for consumption. Like, humans aren't made to eat corn.
Ketchup is so disgusting and it makes everything worse.
My hot take is that white chocolate is not a real chocolate.
A hot dog is not a sandwich.
Fluoride tastes really good.
Grapes and beans are both the same type of item, food item, that I don't like.
I would trade green grapes for a lot of things.
What's your hot take?
Straight men need to be more chivalrous.
Self-diagnosis should not be treated as real diagnosis.
February can be a good month.
My hot take is that mulch actually smells kind of good.
I think Snapchat is an awful form of social media.
Gossip is just analyzing social situations. It's not bad.
Quarter sleeves and half sleeves on shirts are not ugly.
Low-rise pants suck and should not be socially accepted.
I hate hot takes. I think people are so opinionated nowadays that I think people should be more neutral. And no opinion is sometimes good.
If you're keeping track, that's 75 interviews and 75 hot takes.
For WNUR News, I'm Meng Jen Markland.
And I'm Cara Totley.
Well, the fiery ashes from the arena and from those 75 takes have cooled, and the cannons have sounded for everyone. Well, everyone except us. Surprise! Even though President Snow, or our co-workers at WNUR News, might not be too happy, both anchors have survived the entirety of this quarter quell.
Yes, we have. It took a lot of guts, a few helpful sponsors, and massive amounts of both cheating and rigging the simulation, but we pulled it off. Thank you to everyone who tuned in throughout Panem to watch a bunch of teenagers commit some desperate actions. Oh wait, that's just finals week here on campus. We hope you enjoyed our special broadcast. For more news updates and reports, follow us on Twitter or X at WNUR News and Instagram at WNUR News 893.
You can listen to all of tonight's stories in full on our website, WNURnews.org. That's WNURnews.org. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
And of course, this show would not have been possible without our tremendous crew. That starts with Georgia Kerrigan, who has been doing an excellent job serving as our producer tonight. Our reporters have been Sophia Kesa, Gabe Shumway, Meng Jen Markland, Cara Totley, William Kramer, Basil Free, Yumi Talud, and John Kowalski. I have been Brendan Prizman.
And I'm Gabby Shell. Much like catching fire, WNUR News isn't done after the quarter quell finishes. We've got one more week of newscasts starting Monday night. Catch our next newscast on Monday, March 3rd at 6 p.m. And thanks so much for tuning in tonight.
Now, back to scheduled programming. Have a great rest of your night and an amazing weekend.